You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Okay, good afternoon. Thank you very much to all of you for coming today. I would like to thank you, Pablo, my good friend and colleague, Pablo Sanguinetti. He's the chief economist of the CAF, the Development Bank of Latin America, not for Latin America, but of Latin America. It's fully owned by Latin American countries. And we are very proud that at ESPLA, the Brookings Global Series Economic and Social Policy Initiative, it's a pretty long name, but here around we know it as ESPLA. We are pretty proud about the very close collaboration that we have with CAF, and we are looking forward to maintain it in the future. I would like to thank our discussants, Matthew Taylor from American University and Jorge Luis from the World Bank, for sharing with you, with us, your insights. And a very special thanks to Elaine Carmack, who is a very appreciated colleague here at Brookings and an extremely knowledgeable person with a lot of international experience. She was telling us about that right now in the, what you call government innovation, exactly, which is very closely related to what Pablo is going to present. In fact, if I were to have to summarize in one sentence or one expression, what are we going to be talking about today, Pablo? I think that the devil is in the detail. Because we can design very good policies on paper. In fact, I'm not very worried about the design aspect because, in fact, we have CAF, we have the IDB, we have the World Bank. They know a lot about government technology. They know a lot about best practice. So they can really help the country making a good design on paper. But the best design policy of paper, on paper, if you don't have the government agencies and institutions that are prepared to implement them, then the possibility that it will fail, they will fail, it is very large. Moreover, even if you implement them, if these policies are not, and Pablo is going to talk a lot about this, properly evaluated according to predetermined outcomes, in order to have a feedback process by which you learn from your mistakes or from your aciertos, anyhow, your successes. If you don't have that feedback, even a well-designed policy that is implemented might fail simply because you are not actually evaluating it properly and creating the feedback of information that is necessary in a dynamic way to make the policy eventually successful, because these are not policies, these are complex things that do not necessarily generate instant success or you get it right in the first round. You need a lot of iterations in order to get it eventually right. So, and one aspect that I think through experience, I mean, that evaluation, it's not only the fact that you need the capacity to be able to perform it. Sometimes it is the outcome-driven kind of performance is very resisted. In education, that is very obvious. Any initiative that would evaluate in an objective way performance is highly resisted by the establishment. So these are, even in cases where you are prepared to do it, sometimes the politics or the bureaucracy gets in the middle to make it difficult to get. So I think what's important and what's not in building the capacity to design, to implement and to evaluate, and how to get there is what we are going to be discussing today, and therefore, I mean, let us get ready for a very interesting discussion. Thank you very much. Pablo.
Okay, good. Okay, thanks Ernesto. Thanks Julia for organizing this, and thanks all the discussants and moderator for to be here, and you guys also to be here. For us, it's very important to, you know, to not only produce these documents, but also, you know, diffuse these or discuss this with people in the academia, in the policy area, and coming to Brooklyn for us is always a pleasure. So today we are talking about a more effective state's capacities for designing, implementing, and evaluating public policies. As Ernesto was already saying, in here we want to focus not only on the policy debate about what to do, in the sense if you want to build infrastructure, it's better to do it just by the public sector or do it through a private-public collaboration and PPPs. If you open up your country, you have to, you know, how the level of tariffs, high or intermediate level, or whether you want to bring in foreign direct investment, what type of policy to do that. Is beyond policy, there is an issue of designing the specific public initiatives, implementing them, and learn about what you are doing, so to improve in the next round what you are doing, that it is needed. So we want to look at those capacities that will countries allow to do that. Okay? Whatever policy, public policy you think of. So that's why we are here. And let me start with a couple of stories. The first one is from not from Latin America, it's from Asia. In middle of the 19th, there was a diagnosis about the level of the quality of education in rural areas of India. And diagnosis was very awful in the sense that there was a huge difference in the quality on the test on language and mathematics that students were getting in rural areas compared to urban areas within India, okay? So the government, in the beginning of 2000, set up a very ambitious program in which they built new schools in those rural areas. They trained teachers for those new schools. They changed the programs, pedagogic programs, so that are much more closer to interest in this rural area. So it's a huge program. And for that, it takes all the experience of developing the World Bank and all the best practices all over the world. And they got a lot of money. They gave more money to the budget of the schools, et cetera, et cetera. Well, in middle of the 2000s, let's say 2007, they went out to the field to evaluate the program. And even though they found that more students were at school, so access to education increased, the schools were there, were built, they were new, teachers were trained, when they go up to test these students to see whether how much now how higher was the learning compared to previous to the moment that previous they went to schools, the result was basically zero. No change whatsoever in the what children learn in these new schools, new programs. Let me tell you about a story about Latin America now, Colombia. At the beginning of 2000, Colombia launched a very ambitious program to use computers for teaching language in high schools. So it purchased a lot of computers, like 740,000 computers. They were distributed in 40,000 schools. Teachers were trained in terms of how to teach language with these computers. You know, the development of new programs, the computer program for that, et cetera, et cetera. Again, in 2007, 2009, there was evaluation of that program, and they found no result in how in the test scores of students in language. So here are two examples of some policies that in principle are well designed with money, with resources, that some part of the implementation was good, and still they don't, you know, they don't get the expected results. So that's why we think about this issue of state capacity to be important. We want to know about what part of the design, the implementation, or maybe the learning of this about what happens in those programs fail, so that programs don't get the expected results. We think that an effective state, and here we started with the big concepts. You know, what is state capacity? What is an effective state? I mean, you know, you guys, many of you may be political scientists, you know, and economists, and narrow-minded economists. So you may say, you know, huge thing, state capacity. It's about governance, about, you know, governance, about democracy, about civil liberties. So it's huge. Well, as economists, we will take a very narrow point of view. We will think about state capacity in terms of providing a state that is effectively at providing public goods. Okay? It does it in an effective and efficient way. That's how we will define state capacity. So, and for that, what are the abilities that the state needs to do that, to provide efficiently and effectively provide public goods? Well, you may say there are like 10, 15 abilities. Well, we will summarize them in four issues. The first one is, of course, to have a high-quality bureaucracy. Many public goods are very intensive in workers, in public employees. Think about education. You need a lot of teachers. Think about health. You need a lot of nurses, doctors. So you need a high-quality bureaucracy. Second, of course, you may have the best teacher, the best doctor, but the teacher needs, pen, blackboard. Well, that's all style. But they need doctors, need medicine. So you need inputs to provide that public goods. So a system of public procurement is key. Third, civic engagement or citizen participation. You may say, but this is outside the public sector arena. You may say, no, well, you will see. The idea is that you need the engagement of the people that receive those services. They could provide information, they could provide external control, so that they give incentives to these public employees, to this bureaucracy to perform. And fourth, if you want to have people engaging with the public suppliers, the suppliers of public good, you need to give this civil society good information, so that when they approach the public service, they approach them with well informed. So the policy discussion about why that the public service failures or not has to be informed. So that's why you need, at the public sector, you need this monitoring, evaluation, and learning system. But you need those not only for, somehow help the citizens to control the public employees, but you need also within the public sector system, you need that these guys, the bureaucracy, use information that is produced when you supply public goods. There are a lot of administrative information that is very rich, and many times this information is not used to monitor the program, to evaluate the program, and produce feedbacks. So this is a fourth element of I would say state capacity. And of course in the Q&A you may have 10 more, but let's stop that there. So I'm going to discuss a little bit about the four pillars of state capacity that I just mentioned. The first one about bureaucracy. So the message here is it would be nice, one element that it could help you to have a good high-quality bureaucracy in the center to attract the right people to the public sector and give them incentive once they are in the public sector is to have a wage contract that links these wages with career development, responsibility, technical aptitudes, and effort. So, so to have a high-quality bureaucracy, you need people that has, of course, the capacity that is required for a job. If you are working in terms of health, you need doctors, nurses, etc. Second, you need people with integrity, honesty. Okay, they manage public resources, so this is key. Third, motivation. Here we try, in the book, we try to provide new evidence about this idea that public employees many times have, like we call, pro-social motivation. Let's say altruistic ideas. You know, usually, you don't go to the public sector to get millionaire. There are some few exceptions, okay? But usually you don't. So this thing of motivation for the public, you know, is important. And we measure that for public employees in Latin America. And of course, there are measures all over the world. Okay, we talk. And why is motivation important? Because, for example, when you measure that, this is positively correlated with, for example, the desire or the willingness to provide effort at work, for example. It's also positively correlated with less tolerance for corruption. So to identify people that have some kind of high level of public motivation, pro-social motivation, it is a nice thing. Now, once you have the people with capacity, integrity, motivation in the public sector, you want to give them incentives to perform. So that's why, for us, we think it is important the design of a labor contract that do two things. First, attract the people with those features, and then when they are in the public sector, gives incentives to perform, to work. Okay. So now I will give you three features of the, let's say, the wage contract for public employees in Latin America that could not play this role in the sense that could give the wrong incentives. Okay? The first one, less wages. Let's compare wages between the public sector and formal private sector in Latin America. And the first thing that we notice is that on average, public employees for the same level of education, age, and gender, on average, public employees in Latin America earn 20% higher than the formal private employees. That's a lot. Well, this is a feature that is not only in Latin America. In all developing countries, it's the same. Like, for example, in France, they earn 7% more. 7, not 20, 7. We can discuss this, why is this so in the QA. But one thing that maybe that could be a problem is that this differential goes down as employees have more level of education. So when a public sector employee has, say, 17 years of schooling, let's say they complete the university degree, they could earn, and it's a male, could earn 6% less in the public sector compared to the private sector. So this could be a feature that could, you know, disencourage highly educated people to go to the public sector. A second fact that could also be a problem to attract the right people to the public sector. Let's think about now not the level of wages at one time. Let's talk about the wages along the career path, which is also important. So here we are comparing two occupations. One is administrative support, which is has a low demand in terms of human capital, and one occupation which high demand in terms of human capital, professional scientists. And we are comparing here. We are measuring here the differential of the in each occupation of the wage once you enter, and the wage when you have, let's say, 10 or 15 years of experience. So it's like we are looking at how much the wage goes up with experience in each occupation. So you see that for the low demand human capital demanding occupation, administrative support, it's three times higher. A person with a 20 years experience earns three times higher than a person that just entered a job. And there's no difference between private sector and public sector. But for the high skill job, you see that there is a big difference between the private sector and the public sector. You can earn 5.5 times after 20 years of experience in the private sector compared to four times in the public sector. So the idea is not only that for the high qualified people, the level of wages could be low at one moment in time compared to the private sector, is that the wages throughout your career path is much more flatter in the public sector compared to the private sector. And again, this could be a problem. Not only that, is if going up in the, you know, career path in the public sector depends less on what you do, on your effort, like this evidence seems to suggest. This again could generate again problems for choosing the public sector to work. Here we have this data coming from our survey that says that fulfillment responsibility does not increase my chances of promotion. 41% says that in the public sector, and it's much less lower in the private sector, 30%. So going up on the ladder in the, you know, on wages, on responsibilities, the public sector is less meritocratic, we say, in the public sector compared to the private sector. And the third issue that also could distort incentives to work in the public sector is related with the fact that in general, in the public sector, we have a less use of wages that are at least in part tied to performance. So this is about 22% in the public sector compared to 30% in the private sector. We have to be very cautious about this point because there are good reasons to think that in the public sector, pay by performance is less spread because, of course, it's much, much more difficult to measure output in the public sector. Think about, when you work in a foreign affairs office in a country, you know, how to measure performance. I mean, the number of treaties that the country signs, I don't know, it's maybe in some other occupation like teaching and health, you can measure that. But so there are good reasons to think about that, okay, to have this difference. Anyway, all these features of the public sector wage contract in Latin America, we see that generates a little bit of lower satisfaction with promotion and wage progression in public employees. 2 out of 10 are dissatisfied compared to 1 out of 10 in the private sector. Okay? And why we care about dissatisfaction with wage and to promotion, et cetera? Because we found in our survey that this lower level of satisfaction is positively correlated with things associated with delivering effort at your job. For example, you are less willing to help others, you are less willing to stay until late, maybe it's not good, I don't know, maybe less willing to assume new responsibilities, but less willing to participate in training. This is important. Okay? So far I give you some basic features of the wage contract of the public sector in Latin America that could imply some distortions and could affect satisfaction with the job and, you know, the desire to make effort, etc. You may say this is nice, some descriptive information, but some of this could be, it's not that strong evidence in the sense of causal evidence. You know, we economists think about that all the time. Maybe it's a waste of time. But anyway, so for you guys that are scientific-minded people, we try to provide more strong evidence about this, running a couple of experiments using our survey. We did this survey, 10,000, we surveyed 10,000 families in Latin America. With all these questions, and we use our survey to run this informational experiment. So in 4 cities, 4,000 information, we divide the sample, randomly in 2, and to one group, we give this information. We tell the people that actually, in their cities, people with average level of education earn more, get a higher wage in the public sector compared to the private sector. But people that with high level of education earns more in the private sector. And then we ask them, are you willing to, if you have to look for a job in the next 6 months, where do you look for, in the public sector or the private sector? So the result of this kind of experiment, informational experiments, we get that high-performing employees, meaning people with high level of education, are less attracted to work with the in the public sector. Interestingly, there are some heterogeneous results in terms of this motivation issue that I said at the beginning. For example, people with low level of education, medium or low level of education, and less motivated for public sector would go to the public sector. So you don't want to have those guys. The only thing, you are safe here only with the high motivated people that is also high educated. So the highly educated that are highly motivated, they still will go to the public sector. So this is not so bad. We run a second experiment, and I don't think I have time to go to the details, but in this second experiment, with 6,000 families in six cities, we divide the sample, again, randomly in two, and to one group, we give them now information about this fact that in the private sector, it's more common to have a wage, to have your wage tied to some level of outcome, performance, okay? And this is less common in the public sector. So then we ask the guys later in the survey, if you had to work for, look for a job, why would you do it in the public or the private sector? And we found that people that is, you know, high-skilled people and those that are willing to provide high effort are less willing to go to the public sector. So this, again, could be a problem. Okay. Well, I don't have to go to this, but I don't have time. Sorry, but I don't have time. So the idea is 10 minutes. Okay. So the idea is to have a high quality bureaucracy, we have to look at wage contract, good design of wage contract that helps to do two things. First, to attract the people with the right features, and the right features are not only education, but also motivation, and also, you know, and be willing to accept effort. Second, you have to do that, you have to make a lot of effort on recruiting things. And maybe when you do recruiting, you don't only look for the level of education or your experience in the job, but you measure, for example, this thing of motivation. But of course, the third thing to do it is training, provide training. But as I said to you before, people with certain features will take much more opportunity of this training thing. So that's why it's important who you look for, okay? Okay, so let me go now to the second ability or state capacity that we think is important to provide, to efficiently and effectively provide public goods. This is related with public procurement. Here the message is more competition and transparency to buy better. So you know that for the public sector to be a machinery that works, you need, of course, input, not only good people. But of course, when you do, you know, the public sector is a very important buyer of many things in many countries. So the idea that you manage public money to buy things that are important, it could generate room for waste or even worse, corruption. So of course, this procurement system has to have some kind of control mechanisms embedded, okay? And of course, so audits is important. In the chapter, we provide evidence about how auditing these mechanisms had helped to reduce prices, to avoid, you know, direct purchases of the state with private entities, etc. But if you have excessive control, I mean, you are, you know, totally crazy about, you know, corruption, and you, of course, you want to avoid that, and you put a lot of control, a lot of rule, etc., that could be a problem too, because, you know, public employees could get scared about being, you know, prosecuted, being in judiciary, etc., for things that maybe are not their fault, you know. And of course, in Latin America nowadays, we have a lot of examples of that. A lot of politicians, I would say, which is okay. So this was not a thing to say. Okay, anyway, so, but you know, you may have no corruption, that's good, but maybe you may have no public goods, because no one wants to sign anything. You know, so how to avoid this kind of trade-off that excessive control could is okay, but too much of that could, you know, make provision of public goods, you know, take a lot of time, etc. So we think that introducing competition and transparency is a way to ease that kind of difficult balance. Okay. Why? Because this thing of a competition and transparency could give you external control that could complement the internal control. It's very difficult to write down a contract to avoid all possible, you know, uncertainties or ways that the, you know, public employees could get money in their pockets. It's very difficult. So, you know, there's not that such an optimal contract. So for that, for to win that, is, it could help to have external control, and for that you need more information, more competition. So here we put, in the book, we show some examples about how introducing competition mechanisms like reserve auctions to get lower prices have helped, how to use wage pages to, you know, as a mechanism to buy inputs. For example, in Mexico, there is this wage page, we call it Compranet, which has been very successful. In Chile, we have Chile Compra. This allows, you know, you centralize all the purchases of all of many, many small entities, public entities like school districts, etc., and you put more, you know, almost homogenize that, and it allows you to compare prices. It allows you to all of suppliers, wherever they live, you know, in other places, in other regions, to post their offers. So it gets a lot of transparency and competition. So, and this has helped to identify, for example, some cases of corruption. In the case of Mexico, was just using that some, you know, journalists get, they do that. Okay, the other thing is, of course, so fine, okay, of course you have to use... Once you do this kind of audit, you have to publicize this information. In Brazil, nowadays very famous for many things, they have done these audits on municipalities, on public procurement, and those municipalities that were identified with a wrongdoing, you see afterwards the mayor was kicked out, you know, through elections. So that helps too. Okay, let me go to the third capacity. We call it effective civic engagement. If you're gonna use external controls by citizenship to help you to complement internal control, you need to organize people to get first information and two ways of participation that help you to control the public sector and, you know, help you with this improving transparency. Okay? Now, so promote citizen engagement to enhance accountability. This is important. Now, as I tell you, this could help you with external control, but also very important. Sometimes when you launch a new program, a new policy, you're not totally sure about the result that you will get, so through which channels that, for example, in the case of this program in Colombia to use computers to teach language. You know, it's a new program, it's a new thing, teachers are experimenting with that. So you are not totally sure about whether the program will be successful or not. So you need a lot of short-term insights or suggestions from the beneficiaries of the services. So that's why it's also important, the citizen participation. But then you have to organize that. It's not, the market will not do it, okay? The market will not do it. We are talking about institutional issues, and here all of you guys, political science, know better than me that this is not done by the market, okay? 2 minutes? I'm dead, okay. So what about citizen participation in Latin America? Very high participation in terms of voting, okay? But when we go to more direct participation or interaction between publics, you know, service providers and citizens, very low. For example, here is some information about if people sign any petition in the last year, 22% in Latin America, in US, Canada, it's much higher. Here is some information within cities, also very low level of direct participation between providers of public goods. For example, mayors or municipalities and citizens. So why people do not participate? Well, many people think that, you know, making a complaint to a local government, to a public sector provider or a public firm, whatever, is not change anything. So this is one reason. The second is to participate. Sometimes it makes a lot of cost because you have to find the place where you to do your claim. You know, you have to maybe write a thing, follow the bureaucratic step to do that, so costly. And third, sometimes you don't know whether to do that, so you lack information. So how to strengthen participation? Well, maybe now with the revolution of TICs, that could help you a lot. And so we look for how much local governments in Latin America, in 125 cities, use TICs as a way to interact with their, you know, with the citizens in terms of providing public goods. So we measure first if they have a website. So four out of five of these 125 cities have a website with some information about what service they provide, etc. Now, three out of five, they put more information on procedures. So how you make a claim, etc., explaining you things. Now, 2 out of 5 allow you to do transaction, claims, public budget information. And just 1 out of 10, they have this thing of social network that you can actually interact directly with any local authority, in the sense that you send a message to the mayor saying, you are a very nice guy, or saying, I don't like you, okay? So, one important thing. Okay, so just 1 out of 10. So this revolution of TICs on e-government in Latin America is just a bluff. I mean, we have a long way to go, okay? So, I don't have time to do this. Let me go now to the last thing, which is monitoring, evaluation, and learning setting. So why you need this? First of all, to give people more detailed information about how the services are run, that's okay. But more important than that, you want to give information on how the service is working to the guy who is in the front line. So maybe the doctor who is, you know, in a hospital in a rural area wants to know how many patients he attend per month. How many of these guys say that the service was okay? You know, many information which is so. And of course, the public sector, when they do this, they run these services, they generate that administrative information. The problem is that it's not used. So here is that why we call it monitoring, evaluating, and learning systems, okay? Policy learning is a key to strengthen public management. So in the region, there were some good news about this, because they have been created some specialized institutions to do that. Like, for example, Coneval in Mexico, okay? Now, in many of these countries, in some of these countries, this monitoring and evaluation system covers a high proportion of the public budget. I mean, Chile is almost 100%. They have, in their budget, they have performance tied indicator for each line of the budget. So it allows you to follow, to get a more oriented, result-oriented public sector. Third, they have a special legal framework that says what should be part of this monitoring system, what type of methodology to use. Fourth, of course, you have to have a good statistical. So third capacity starts by having good statistics at the government level. And some governments, let me tell you, coming from where I come in, it's not obvious, okay? Fourth, results should be available to the public. And sixth, learning. I have no more time. Why is learning important? Because we want all this information through the monitoring evaluation system to help to improve public management. Many times this is done, this is in a web page, and it's just used for, public, for the public, for the academic, but it's not used by the guy who is a frontliner public servant to improve his management. Many times when you talk about evaluation, public employees get very nervous because it's like, you want to use that to fire me. No. It should be used. These public employees should think about this as a tool for improving what he's doing. So that's why learning is important. I don't have more time, so I will finish saying, going back to what? To the story we have at the beginning. Asia, India. So I told you that there was this program for improving education in rural area in India. It was a lot of money, new schools, training teachers. So, and I still didn't get the expected result. When they do this evaluation in 2006, they found one issue related with implementation that was a little bit overlooked. What was that? Well, before the program, teachers didn't go to school 48, out of 100 in times. So 48% of absentees. After the program, the absentee rate was the same, 48%. So you have very good teachers, these trained teachers in their homes, not at schools. So this is crazy. This is very important. So you see how One important thing that, regarding implementation, we was let's change this, was not somehow was overlooked. I mean, you have for example, pay these guys a little bit more, you know, pay by performance to go to school. You may have, for example, a monitoring system that tells you, you know, rapidly who is going, who's not, or empower parents so that the parents will look at that, you know, be aware of that, and you put a complaint to the local authority, etc. You didn't. In the case of Colombia. Well, the evaluation that they did in 2007 shows that 42% of the teachers that were trained to use the computer didn't use it, actually. Didn't use it. So again, in that, this is another thing of implementation. To change the way you do things, you know, you have to, it's not just they teach you how to do new things. You have to be embodied in your mind. You have to have a psychological new, you know, way to do things. You see, it's much more than just telling you what you do. So somehow this doesn't happen. So again, we have to look at those things because, as Ernesto was saying, the devil is in the details. Thank you very much.
Okay, I want to thank Pablo for this very interesting introduction and talk. This is a topic dear to my heart because many years ago I worked on this topic with the American government, running a little program called Reinventing Government for the federal government. And since then I've worked around the world in government capacity issues. As Pablo was talking, I was struck by both the similarities and the differences. The problem, of course, in the U.S. government and in many developed countries is exactly as Pablo pointed out. At the top of the wage scale, the government's got problems retaining talent. Okay, they're just simply not competitive. In procurement, however, most of the developed countries, including the United States, have the opposite problem. They have excessive controls. And the excessive controls mean that you get the horror stories like $700 hammers at the Department of Defense. And you get, my favorite is a Learjet for the military, requires this much paperwork, and a Learjet for a private sector like Donald Trump or something requires this much paperwork. So the developed countries have gone in the other direction in terms of procurement, although there's a lot of progress on this around the world. Most of the people in the developed countries do their governmental transactions online. There's huge progress on that, whether it's Spain, whether it's England, the U.S., almost everything is online. But as in Latin America, almost no one is using this effectively to communicate with elected officials. That has not happened in the U.S. either, and I'm not quite sure what this is about, but it's the links between the public and the administrative state, not to mention the elected officials, have been difficult. And finally, this business of learning. The U.S. government isn't very good at learning either, but they have an advantage that is missing in most developing nations, which is they have a reliable statistical operation. The Bureau of Labor Statistics, whatever, they have real statistics. And real statistics help other people evaluate the government, even if the government itself isn't willing to evaluate the government. I've called all of these things the infrastructure of modern government. And I'm a political scientist, but for the economists here, we know how important infrastructure is to the economy, right? Well, I think the way to think about the work that Pablo's been doing and his group has been doing and the work that everyone up here does is create an infrastructure is as important, if not more, to a modern government as it is to a modern economy. So with that, I'd like to introduce two distinguished discussants for today's panel. To my immediate left is Jorge Silva. He is a public sector specialist from the World Bank. And to his left is Matthew Taylor, an associate professor of American University. And if you could each take a couple minutes to talk about Pablo's presentation and expand on it, I'd appreciate it. So you want to start with Matthew? Okay.
Well, I thank you very much, and thank you, Ernesto and Julia, for the invitation. Congratulations to CAFE and to Pablo. This is really an impressive report that covers just an amazing amount of terrain, and I think, from my perspective, is just fascinating because this is a field where we haven't done enough work, and much more research is needed. I'm a political scientist, and the joke, of course, is that political scientists are bad sociologists who want to be bad economists. The reason I make that joke is to make the point that I think is important in sort of framing this report and its importance, which comes out of sociology, and I think, Pablo touched on this, but I think that it's important perhaps to touch on it a little bit more. The concept of Weberianness, the concept of Weberian state capacity, which includes meritocratic recruitment, predictable long-term careers, has been very closely correlated with economic growth and better development outcomes. But the reason that that functions that way has a great deal to do with social norms. That is, that merit-based hiring, long-term careers, esprit de corps, corporate coherence, all of that contributes to creating an environment in which bureaucrats or civil servants, whatever we want to call them, internalize shared norms and internalize organizational norms and sort of organizational goals. And that creates a structure that is unprecedented in human history when it emerges in the, we can say, the 18th century, 19th century. I think that this point about the sociology of bureaucracy is very important. Because it does make the connection between these kind of amorphous rules of bureaucracy and economic-type outcomes, which are organizational incentives to individual bureaucrats that nonetheless add up to better long-term performance by organizations. So as a political scientist, I feel like I can make this link between sociology and economics. But as a political scientist, I also have to just go and mess everything up and muddy the waters a great deal here. And let me just suggest that I think that this report is wonderful because it really gives us a starting point for really muddying the waters in a wonderful number of ways. The first thing I would say is simply that the more that I've worked on state capacity, the more shocked I am at the lack of empirical research that's out there. The empirical work on state capacity, there's not as much dialogue as there should be across disciplines. There's not a lot of great data. And so I really congratulate CAFE for putting together this report, which includes survey evidence, and also does a wonderful job of summarizing a lot of the literature, and I think sets the stage for future research. But having said that, I think that in muddying the waters, I'll point to a couple of different things that perhaps future researchers could be thinking about. The first is simply the inconstancy or the varieties of ways in which we should be thinking about state capacity and the role of bureaucrats. Hillel Seufer and others have pointed to the path dependence of state capacity in Latin America and the way that it, you know, there's been very little change. If you look at state capacity in many countries at the turn of the 20th century, of the 19th to the 20th century, and compare it to the turn from the 20th to the 21st century, there's an extraordinary path dependence there. A second issue that that the report raises, but I think we should perhaps draw more attention to, is how state capacity varies not just across states but also within states, either because of the weak territorial reach of the state, which is something that we see in Latin America in a number of countries, or because different agencies, as in Brazil, are known as islands of excellence or perhaps laggards of some sort. And then in that same vein, I would just point out, I've been doing some comparison in my own work of the U.S. and Brazil, and without any value judgment about the federal bureaucracy in those two countries, I would point to the fact that the logic by which civil services function is enormously different. And so in particular, looking at the wage data that you put up there, wages in Brazil are significantly higher than they are in the United States. But in both countries, if you're well-educated, staying in the civil service past, you know, a certain number of years isn't perhaps the most rational decision from an economic perspective. And we have to explain it, I think, because of shared norms or commitment to the bureaucracy. But the other thing that I wanted to raise with that comparison is the fact that the logic for entering the civil service and leaving the civil service is very different in the two countries. And so we see that in the United States, for example, in the Treasury Department, people come in, they spend a few years, and they leave. Other cohorts of bureaucrats stay in the whole time, and those people who leave frequently come back late in their career after working in private sector. And we don't see that in Brazil. And so I think, you know, I just wanted to raise that as a way of thinking a little bit about how the political system and the overall logic of the state may lead to conclusions that are not universifiable across the entire region. I'm glad that you mentioned, Elaine, your work in the U.S. government, and I think you made reference to the new public management, what we all know as
what we call it. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, this has fallen somewhat out of favor, but I think that the basic insight of new public management, if I can summarize it in a rather crude way, is the Goldilocks story, right? And the Goldilocks story of new public management is really that all of the things that we think are good in controlling the bureaucracy are good up to a point. And Pablo made reference to this in his presentation. But if you go too far on any one of them, you unduly constrain the bureaucracy, or you may create other incentives that are quite negative. So I just want to touch on a few of those. The first, of course, is political autonomy. And going back 50, 60 years to the work of Bendix and others like him, who are drawing, of course, on Weber 50 or 60 years prior to themselves, what you see is a longstanding debate on whether political autonomy helps or hurts. And so on the one hand, political control ensures that the state bureaucracy responds to political directives, but on the other, it hurts because, and I'm repeating myself here, it makes the state respond to political directives. And so, you know, I think either one of those is bad, and so there's this Goldilocks moment in the middle. The second, which Pablo also mentioned, is the formalism of the rules that we impose on the state bureaucracy. And so, you know, this is also your point about how many forms you have to fill out. And this is, of course, also the thesis of Francis Fukuyama's new book on the decay of institutions, that at some point, the excessive formality that we impose on the state in order to reduce discretion and reduce civil service discretion gets in the way of efficiency. And in Latin America, the literature points to the fact that in addition to that, it may also permit patrimonial practices or clientelistic practices to get hidden behind a veil of impersonal bureaucracy. And so Getulio Vargas's famous phrase, you know, for my enemies, the law, for my friends, everything, right? And I think that's a good sort of expression of that. Third, incentive pay. And here, you know, the report spends a good amount of time on this, incentive pay for performance, that is. And I think that this is, of course, a great way of mobilizing people, but there's an enormous principal agent problem in the public sector. And in the Chilean case, I remember reading about what happened when they introduced performance pay in the federal civil service. Many agencies were getting to 98, 99% of civil servants receiving performance pay. They can't all be doing that good a job. So, you know, I think that this is one of these trade-offs. And I also think, going back to the sociologist in me, the bad sociologist, but there's also, I think, a different personality type that is interested in civil service careers. And so I wonder about the results of the survey. I mean, I just think that it doesn't necessarily mean that civil servants are lazy. It just means that they may be more risk averse than the typical private sector entrepreneur. And we expect that in a society.
Of course.
Right? And so your survey indicates this, but I wonder if the interpretation might be slightly different. And then in terms of citizen oversight, I really like your decision to look at what motivates participation in the report. But I also wonder what we can say about the information available to these citizens who do participate and how interested they are and how self-interested they are. And, you know, going back to my master's studies of public policy, I remember, Lowy's famous argument about the different types of policy and the types of politics that they generate. And, you know, he makes the point that distributive policies have very different politics from regulatory policies or redistributive policies. And so this is also very significant, I think, and we might want to use the false cognate from Portuguese, we might want to problematize this. let me just conclude with a final point, and that has to do with the dependent variable that I think is of interest to all of us, which is the effectiveness of policy. And in the report, the report uses the term efficiency, but I think that future research might try to go further and think about what Paulo Roberto Mota has called the distinction between efficiency, efficacy, and effectiveness. And your anecdotes about India really go to this. So if we think about what efficiency is processes. How do processes work? How did they happen? How did the policy go? What inputs did you put in and what kind of outputs did you get out? In terms of efficacy, what we're thinking about is what happened? What was the quality of the process that was implemented? And so, you know, did we get what we anticipated? Do we get better attendance by teachers or by students? And then finally, and this is where nobody has made the empirical connection, I don't think, effectiveness. At a broader level, how does state capacity contribute to ensuring that policies actually have the long-term effects that we would like them to have? And this seems to me like the big gap that empirical research needs to cover. What difference does it make? And we tend to ask this about public policy. So how do school absenteeism programs work? But we're not thinking about what that does in terms of better education outcomes. So congratulations and thank you.
Thank you much.
Thank you. Jorge?
Thank you. First, I want to thank Pablo from CAF
for inviting me to provide these remarks today. Thanks a lot, Pablo. I very much appreciate the opportunity to share reflections on governance and the role of the state in Latin America. First, I would like to commend CAF for this phenomenal report. The capability of the state to effectively design and implement public policies are center stage, especially given the recent events in Brazil and Panama. And this report is a welcome contribution. The report's focus on learning at the intrastate level and among states. It contains useful benchmarks for comparing states that will make it a lasting reference for anyone seeking to better understand them. Today, I want to devote my time to make three remarks that relate the report to my professional experience. The first one is about neglected differences at the intrastate level capacity. The second one is related to learning. And finally, I want to offer some thoughts on the ability of the state to solve some complex problems by presenting an example involving the Colombian procurement agency, Colombia Compra Eficiente. On intrastate capabilities, the state consists of many subunits, provinces, municipalities, urban agglomerations, to name a few, with varying capacities. And the difference between them are often neglected, or worse, bundled to simplify complexity. Capabilities across these subunits vary widely. While some institutions within the states, such as the central bank or treasury, often have good physical and human infrastructure, other state institutions, such as in the justice sector, may be literally falling apart at the seams. Tribunals all over Latin America operate under difficult conditions. They rarely possess reliable data, and/or this is not available to the public. Should the CAF report have covered institutions of the judicial branch, it most likely wouldn't have had access to reliable statistics. A second thought on learning. As the report rightly indicates, state capacities are not a static, but a dynamic concept. And the difference is what we call the meta-capacity to learn. The report ends with this message. I quote, "The institutionality of learning should respond to the fact that, despite the great variety of contexts and realities in which the presence of the state is applied, there is a sea of knowledge in the policy experience itself that can help shorten the path to share an equitable well-being." End of quote. But how does this learning occur? How do lessons learned in one context apply to another? How do lessons, for example, in competition law in Colombia inform policy debates in Argentina or Paraguay? Are lessons learned there easy, difficult, or impossible to implement elsewhere? This is where I found the report at its most assertive. Institutional knowledge from the intrastate level is very different than knowledge from outside. The report also states, "The probability that learning leads to improvement in the evaluated policy is conditioned more by the political environment, institutional frictions, the weight of diverse interest groups that may have created in relation to the intervention. This is not an excuse to obfuscate lessons or an inability to improve, but the reality to the reform. I believe that institutional knowledge is, for the most part, local. International comparisons are useful as signaling devices and for academic publications, but learning happens locally because it involves not just formal, but also informal interactions. This is something that the narrative of international best practices lack. A third point on procurement. I pay particular attention to the section on public procurement, a subject in which I've been recently working in Colombia. Overall, I found it insightful and representative of a wider phenomenon in which data is slowly starting to change the nature of the discussions, where anecdotal evidence is being replaced by hard data. Data is being collected at an unprecedented rate and will change the trajectory of procurement reforms for the better. Nevertheless, public procurement lies at the heart of much broader and more difficult problems at the intrastate level, and looking at procurement in isolation misses the bigger point. Let me elaborate on this idea with one example. Colombian Procurement Agency enthusiastic director asked us to study why there is so much direct contracting in Colombia. More than half of all government contracts are directly procured at the central level. At the subnational level, more than two-thirds. Why most contracts are procured this way? Are norms being violated or conveniently circumvented? The explanation that we found was somewhat obscure and complex, with one key difference. We back it up with data. Without boring you with the details, we combined millions of contracts with budget data and civil service data and found that loose and inconsistent definitions in the law, coupled with a structural deficit of civil servants and budget inflexibilities, had prompted the development of a pseudo-informal sector within the state, an army of professional service contractors. In some government agencies, there was one contractor of every two civil servants in 2014. A myriad of exceptions to rules allow different sectors to optimize their labor demand between contractors and civil servants. In a country where one of every two workers is part of the informal labor market and where some of the largest non-wage labor costs exist, who could be surprised to learn that the state also reflects part of this national reality? Direct contracting turned out to be more a problem of labor informality and budgetary inflexibilities than one of procurement law or corruption. Neglecting this link could lead one to think that somewhere down to the road, the right procurement reform will solve the issue. That's wrong. Without a concerted effort involving treasury, procurement, and the civil service, a real solution would not be reached. These are the real problems a state faces, interconnected and impossible to solve in isolation. Finally, for us to build problem-solving capabilities at the intrastate level, we need to go beyond definitions, composite indicators, and best practices, and actually create much more and better data. Larry Summers recently remarked in a speech he gave at the World Bank that data collection is the ultimate public good. Reliable, useful data is what distinguishes solid, evidence-based policy. But generating data of the operation of the intrastate level is difficult and costly because the openness and transparency of such data may affect powerful groups with vested interests. I would like a state more worried about creating information, tidying up and codifying its everyday activities than recombining them in ever more creative but meaningless composite indicators. States need to spend more effort in producing better data and a little less time on naming and shaming with composite indices. CAP has produced a very useful report. This will become part of our ongoing conversation on how to improve institutions. Thanks a lot, Pablo. Thanks a lot, Helen. Thank you.
Thank you, Jorge. Okay, I'd like to go right to audience questions, if I could, because we're running out of time. Why don't we start with the gentleman here, and we'll move around. Okay.
Me?
Yes.
Hi, thank you. Hi, my name is Juan Felipe Celia. I'm from Colombia. And I wanted to ask, Alva, thank you for your interventions. And I wanted to ask about the role of politicians, our much beloved political class in Latin America. And because there's a certain progression here where politicians get elected with the help of powerful groups with vested interests, as you said. And then the politicians usually have access to appointing the so-called cuotas políticas. So they get to, appoint people at the in local institutions, right? I'm talking about public institutions at the subnational level in the regions outside of, in my case, Bogota. And then once they're in place, they're usually close to a certain political group or a certain, powerful group, and then they use the mechanism of direct contracting or, they just, work around the legal framework to, for example, maybe have one bidder, only one bidder instead of doing it directly. And then that money that's supposedly spent in, for services does not get spent well. And then that leads to citizens being disenchanted with public institutions and then not engaging with their public institutions. So my question is about, what, for example, could you think are some measures that could be taken to improve this institutional capacity at the local level in terms of either preventing public politicians from appointing public the leaders of these local institutions freely or improving the contracting process so they can't give the contracts in charge of service provision to this? Thank you.
Pablo, do you want to? Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you, Matthew, Jorge, Elaine, for your comments. Well, let me start with this last question, which is very difficult. I mean, and the book that doesn't address that. Okay. So I sort of summarize some state capacities that we think are very important to effectively provide public good. And I answer one of your questions. You see the title. The title was an effective state. We don't call it an efficient state, because as taking the idea from the new public management literature, we are thinking of state in terms of results. How much the states, through this public services, change welfare of people, change the development, etc. So we are more toward a more oriented or result-oriented public management. So that's why the notion of effectiveness. So we don't need to be efficient in terms of low cost. We want to do that. What they do, they have impacts. Okay. So your question is, you know, if you have a local politicians that they use the state just a political machinery, you know, to hire political-oriented public employees, or of course they use public procurement to finance campaigns, etc. It's like you are dead. I mean, nothing of these things is going to be applied. I mean, of course, this is so somehow to do any of this, you need some political guiding, political motivation, a guy that wants to change the things. And you may say, so if all our politicians are just office motivated, are corrupt, Latin America should be in a very bad state. And we are not, even though recent news are not that good. In the sense that you see in many countries, like Peru is doing a huge reform in terms of civil servants, for example, the public teachers. Mexico did the same with teachers. Many countries are starting doing this reform. And sometimes the interest of the politician coincides with the interest of the citizenship. For example, right now, that you have a moment of scarcity of resources. How this public sector should accommodate to this new area? Well, one is to cut expenditure, the other to increase taxes. The other is to improve effectiveness. So some politicians will try to take this agenda and, you know, help them to do a better job. I don't know. I don't answer your question, but.
Great. Ernesto, right here.
I have, since all of you somehow or the other mentioned the same stylized fact, you put a lot of emphasis to Elaine. Why is it so difficult to retain talent in the public sector, i.e. why talented is not remunerated in the way it should be? Second, why do you think we see in Latin America very few outcome-oriented evaluation systems? And why, and this is a very interesting concept I heard from you, Elaine, that the U.S. has very good information, and although the U.S. doesn't do a very good job in evaluating itself, others do a good job on the basis of the data collection on evaluating the government. In many of our countries, we collect good information, but we are very opaque in actually sharing the information. So we don't want to evaluate ourselves, and at the same time, we don't want to share the information that would allow others to evaluate us. And I would like to ask you whether, because nobody mentioned that, whether very powerful workers' unions in the public sector, and this is, have anything to do with all of the above.
I'll start that. First of all, the United States does not have powerful public sector unions. It probably has the weakest public sector unions in the world, so that's not the answer. I think the answer goes back to a professional civil service and a very long history and culture of statutory protections of the civil servants. So the Bureau of Labor Statistics has a methodology. people quarrel about the methodology and say that it has political consequences here and there. But the bottom line is they hew to their methodology and they put out labor statistics that are pretty reliable. The way I used to bring this home to my classes at the Kennedy School was I would end this discussion of statistics on why doesn't President Obama get to cheat? And this was during the 2012 election. Unemployment was really very high. Okay, it was a big problem for him. But he could not go out and say, oh, no, unemployment's 3%. It's not 6.5%, 7%, right? And the reason is that there's too many institutions, but a central government institution. And a lot of this is culture, but a lot of this is law. I mean, it's Donald Trump is sort of laughable. He's going to fire everybody. If the president of the United States walks into the Bureau of Labor Statistics and says, I don't like your numbers, I'm firing you, what happens? Well, it goes straight to court. He doesn't fire him at all, okay? So there's, now, that has this complete insulation. There is really serious insulation of many American political civil servants and British and Australian and Canadian from politicians. And it produces good outcomes in terms of honest statistics. It also, however, has its problems, okay? Because, in fact, in many of those countries, Britain and the United States, I know the best, a lot of times the politicians get elected to do one thing and the bureaucracy says, oh, no, you don't. And, in fact, they often win, okay? So, I think that there is a real... It was interesting that Pablo began with this question of the civil service, that a professionalized and politically insulated civil service in general does more good than harm, although there are some problems with it. So that would be my short answer to that.
And let me tell you, coming from Argentina, in which, you know, without any judgment, at some point we have a political system that tried to do those things, statistics, change the judiciary. You see, there were limits. There were limits. It either worked. I mean, of course, there was a lot of public sector appointments. But still, there were over there some guys in the public sector that were, you know, that were hired by some of these rules to be motivated, pro-social motivation, that the job was to provide public sector, I was not to, you know, to do politics. That at a certain point said, okay, no, this is not my job description. And they stop it, and they denounce on the judiciary. So, you see, the question is, many times, politics, of course, can make things wrong in the sense that you want to do that things. But even if you have some of this stuff, a little bit of that, they will, at some point, put a barrier on the abuse and et cetera. And we have very important examples in our country. So once you get to a certain level of middle income and some level of institutionalization, I'm not talking about Africa, okay? You know, these things could even stop, a government that wants to polarize everything and go beyond the limits. And we have very nice examples of that. Mm-hmm. So I would say the other way around. A bureaucracy that has been built on some of these principles at some point could moderate, deviation from politics, or could stop deviation from politics. So this is something that we should think about. Yeah.
Other questions? Yes, back there.
Shouldn't, since these problems or challenges which you have just mentioned, and especially Professor Taylor, identified those, shouldn't they make some best practices checklists for the countries? Because this problem does not exist only in Latin America. Yeah. It exists in Caribbean. It exists in some Asian countries except Singapore. It exists in Africa, virtually every country of Africa. Shouldn't there be a checklist by World Bank or IDB are those institutions which have some government support that they must change for good, that they should be a checklist of 20 items for institutions, so the institutions are strong, 20 items for maybe how they qualify for loans in future from World Bank and all, and then perhaps you will have a model country, which in each region, shouldn't there be a model country like Singapore, maybe somewhere in Africa, created a model country so that everyone can start following up of those.
Jorge, you want to react to that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit of against to what I mentioned in my talking points, but basically, I mean, of course, in the World Bank, we have a number of indicators. A lot of these indicators are used for different purposes, but I would say that indicators are not, a general tool for having an idea of a particular topic, performance of a particular area in countries, but we shouldn't really think that what indicator said is the exact reality of the situation in the country. And I would say that, you really need to know more about the local situation and go to the places to actually have a grasp on what you need to do there.
Can I give you a perfect example of this? And I was thinking of this when you were talking before. I find myself in my consulting often doing things that I never thought I would do. So I was in a country that you know well, doing some work with the new president and his team, and they explained this problem of many, many, many contractors in the government. And so the first reaction was, well, you've got to get rid of the contractors and, you know, because they're mucking up the civil service. And then they explained something that you couldn't see from a report, which is that the contractors were young and educated, and the civil servants were old and uneducated, and that if you, in fact, got rid of the contractors, you would basically stop the government from working. So, you know, this would happen to me time and time again. When we did Reinventing Government in the Clinton administration, we were always trying to get rid of the inspectors general because we thought they were an impediment to management. And yet, I can't tell you how many developing countries I've been in where I've said, you know, you ought to have an inspector general. So this is to Jorge's point that, yes, there are checklists, but you really do have to be on the ground and understand a little bit of the context of each country.
Yes, much more difficult.
Yeah.
You know, it's okay. I mean, you may say, this country have a like bureaucracy capturing or hiring that respects some basic, basic principle of meritocratic. Okay, they may on law have that, but things on the ground could work very different. So it's no, you know, you have to go there and understand the setting, incentives, and why people go out, you know, through the around the law. So it's more than that.
I think we have time for one final question. Yes, sir.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Michael McCarthy. I work at American University Center for Latin American Studies. I really enjoyed the conversation, and I guess this question really is for Pablo. I haven't had an opportunity to read the report, but what struck me about the discussion, and in particular your presentation, was the lack of a discussion or lack of an emphasis on the fact that it isn't that we have a good understanding of what we want from a state. It's getting there that is the problem, right? The story is really one of developmental issues, right? And state effectiveness is ultimately a story of state building and how you get there. So what in your report, what does your report have to say about that issue? Because it's not so much that we lack an understanding of what the state should look like at the end of the day, as the discussion has suggested, but what are the stories about how you get there, and what are the variables that are relevant there? Because it seems to me that in order to really advance on this front, we need to tell the story in real time, which means considering political variables, as some of the other people mentioned in their questions. Thank you.
Okay, good, very good point. But you know, we thought. When we talk about the bureaucracy that has to have some incentives and some certain features and the one your wage contract to have to give you that, of course you can prove that, you can reform that, but again, as you said, we have to learn about that. So we want to put a mechanism to learn whether once you give a little bit of an incentive, let's say by performance, is that working or not? maybe we get the wrong level of the you know, very small or too big, or it was difficult to measure. So that's why we say the learning thing, which is the last thing, is very important to do exactly that, to set in motion, a dynamic thing in which you learn for what you are doing. The first thing that you have to be, you have to emphasize is bureaucracies have to learn of themselves. You have to, so, and this is within the job description of the state. So if you get the policy not that good, this is not that, to kill yourself. I mean, it's part of the learning mechanisms. But the government have to set in motion that kind of stuff so people will understand that. So a kind of partial failure, let's say the educational thing in Colombia. You know, if you publicize that, maybe there are big, titles in newspapers. The government failed to do that, they was inept. No, you have to say, okay, we do the evaluation, and we realize that some teachers don't have incentive to do that, but other teachers, they tell us, because of their experience, that using computers to teach language is not good. It's not good. That's okay. So we learn something from that. You see, so we have to think about the public sector that learns, and also the public learns from that. And to set this kind of agenda is kind of different from the agenda that sometimes, international multilaterals we do. They say, you should do this, this, and this. No. You should learn what you do.
Yeah.
That's the only thing that you should do. Learn from your mistakes. Everyone makes mistakes. The problem, the right thing is you don't learn from that. That's the key thing.
Great. I want to thank Ernesto and his center for putting this program together. Pablo, congratulations on a great report. Matthew and Jorge, thank you for joining us this afternoon.